Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Transportation Committee to order. Today is Saturday, April 27th, 2024. We are in the Barnes Committee Room, Room 124, the Alaska State Capitol Building. Let the record reflect that the time is 1:02 p.m. Today we have President Representative Craig Johnson, Representative McKay, Representative Vance, Representative Sumner, Representative Stutes, and myself, Chair McCabe. The staff assisting us today are Recording Secretary Linda Jensen, Moderator Susan Quigley, and Angela Steffel, my committee aide. And here comes Representative Mina. Yay! If everyone, thank you ladies for your service. If everyone could silence their cell phones, that'd be great. First, let me say I appreciate everybody coming in on a Saturday. The people that are running skits actually paid me to do this, to keep you all around so you could go to skits tonight. So, So, I appreciate everybody being here, and we're getting towards the end of session, and I don't normally like Saturday meetings, but we wanted to try to wrap some bills up for some important bills for Senator Klayman and for both of those, I think, are Senator Klayman's and Representative Tomaszewski's. So, today we have two items of business, SB 127, an act relating to vehicle rental taxes, relating to the issuance of subpoenas related to tax records, and providing for an effective date, sponsored by Senator Klayman. It's my plan to hear that bill, hear invited in public testimony, and move it on to next committee. And in its second hearing, and next is HB 233 in its second hearing. We'll work on amendments, hear public testimony, and set it aside until Tuesday under bills previously heard. So, with that, let's begin. SB 127, Senator Klayman and your staff, Ms. Carly Dennis, please come to the table, place your names on the record, and begin your introduction and reading of the sectional analysis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for meeting on Saturday. For the record, I'm Senator Matt Klayman. I represent District H, West Anchorage. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 127. Over the past several years, the use of vehicle rental platforms such as Turo and Getaround has greatly increased. These companies offer an easy way for Alaskans to rent out their cars directly, often to supplement their income. As it stands, however, there is no easy way for Alaskans using these online platforms to comply with the existing state vehicle rental tax law. Senate Bill 127 requires that the vehicle rental platforms collect the existing state vehicle rental tax and remit the tax to the Department of Revenue. Additionally, Senate Bill 127 revises the subpoena provisions that relate to the Department of Revenue tax collections. This bill was introduced by our office at the request of the Department of Revenue. The department informed our office that vehicle rental owners who rent through peer-to-peer car-sharing networks owe the vehicle rental tax under existing law, but the law requires a new section to specify that the vehicle rental platform will be responsible for collecting and remitting the tax. I will note that in 2020, the municipality of Anchorage adopted similar legislation requiring vehicle rental platforms to collect and remit the city's 8% vehicle rental tax. Discounting the impacts of COVID-19 on rentals in 2020, the vehicle rental tax revenue to the municipality of Anchorage has increased substantially in the years since the adoption of that ordinance. The Finance Committee substitute for Senate Bill 127 makes two important changes to the legislation. First, it lowers the vehicle rental tax rate for vehicle rental platforms from 10% to 8%. The tax remains at 10% for traditional rental operations such as Hertz, Avis, Enterprise. Second, the bill eliminates the window for the Department of Revenue to retroactively collect taxes. Now, vehicle rental platform owners, or the vehicle owners, not the platform, who had not previously been collecting the tax, could owe the back taxes, and this will protect those individuals from having to pay back taxes. Only taxes in the future would be collected by the platform. With this new committee substitute, stakeholders previously on different sides of the debate are now in agreement. Turo, Enterprise, Avis have all offered letters of support for the current version. Finally, I will note that the money raised from the vehicle rental tax goes to the Department of Transportation and to state parks historically. It makes good sense to require collection of this tax and ensure that the folks who rent cars and drive on Alaska's roads and enjoy our parks also help to maintain those services. And with that, I will pass it on to my staff, Carly Dennis, to go through a sectional analysis.
Perfect. Ms. Dennis, place your name on the record, and away we go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carly Dennis, staff to Senator Klayman. Section 1 amends AS 4305-04C by removing unnecessary language regarding the issuance of out-of-state subpoenas related to tax records. Section 2 establishes a separate tax rate of 8% for passenger vehicles rented through vehicle rental platforms. The tax rate remains 10% for other rentals. Section 3 amends AS 4352-05A by adding language clarifying that vehicle rental platform companies and other companies that arrange vehicle rentals and leases shall collect the existing state vehicle rental tax and remit the tax to the Department of Revenue. Vehicle rental platforms collecting the tax pay the tax quarterly. Section 4 amends AS 4352-05 by requiring a vehicle rental platform that arranged or executed more than 200 transactions in the state in the preceding calendar year to collect and pay to the department the taxes imposed under AS 4352-10 through 4352-99. It also clarifies that a vehicle rental platform is not liable for failing to collect or pay the vehicle rental tax if they were provided with incorrect or insufficient information. The company must demonstrate that a reasonable effort was made to obtain the correct or sufficient information from the person, and it defines motor vehicle, vehicle rental platform, and vehicle rental platform company. Section 5 amends uncodified law. The Department of Revenue may not, on or after the effective date of this act, assess and collect vehicle rental taxes that were imposed before the effective date of this act on a transaction arranged or executed through a vehicle rental platform. If the tax is not assessed and collected before the effective date of this act, proceedings may not be instituted in court for the assessment or collection of this tax. And finally, Section 6 sets an immediate effective date. This concludes the sectional analysis.
Thank you. So, any questions from the committee? What?
I know I'm letting you down.
Mr. Rules Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm not sure this, to whom this question goes, but providers of the private individual, have any of those people paid taxes up till now? And if so, do they get a rebate on those taxes? Is there anything here that allows for them to get their money back because fair and equal treatment or anything in that?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I think the best party to answer that would be folks from Department of Revenue who are online and can answer that question. In terms of whether taxes have been collected, the second question is, are there any rebates in place for people that if they did pay taxes, this bill does not provide for any rebates. It's only a forward-looking measure.
Okay, and so I think the Department of Revenue got...
Sure. I think probably Brandon Spanos would be the best one. He's the Deputy Tax Director, Department of Revenue. Mr. Spanos, can you hear us? I think you're on Teams, right?
Yes, I am, and I can hear you.
Okay, great. So did you hear the Representative Johnson's question? I think the question was, are the Turo folks currently paying taxes?
Yeah, and basically, excuse me. If they have been paying taxes, are they due a rebate of any form based upon this new legislation?
So through the chair, Representative, the tax has been, and you'll see in our presentation, the tax is currently under current statute due. It is owed as soon as a vehicle is rented on any platform. In the state, be it by a corporation or an individual. And so we have done some work in years past to get that message out to taxpayers, and some taxpayers have complied and filed and paid taxes. The number is not very large. I could probably count on my two hands how many taxpayers in 1 year have filed and paid taxes for the vehicle rental tax. There are some outstanding assessments in our system as well for certain of those taxpayers. There was a period of time when this legislation was being introduced that assessments were paused because we're waiting for the legislation to go through. So we haven't had anyone file a pay for a couple of years now.
Follow up.
Thank you. I still don't think that answers my question. The number of you can count on your hands, are they due a rebate because of the retroactivity in this for giving the people who have been charged or assessed who chose not to pay or getting relief are those people who basically obeyed the law and paid the tax. Are they due any relief?
So through the chair, Representative, that the way that I read the bill does not allow relief for those that did file and pay. I'd probably want to check with law and get an opinion there on because, yes, on its face, it does appear that that would be an unfair treatment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Stutz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I will, along that very line, it would seem to me that maybe they could make an accommodation that they would have a credit going forward if they paid previously.
So through the chair, Representative Stutz, I would feel most comfortable if that was in statute because I don't want to overstep my authority.
Thank you.
Representative Sumner.
Mr. Chair, if I may. Mr. Chair, this is Deputy Commissioner Lamani.
Yes, sir, Mr. Lamani, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that question. As Acting Director Spanos mentioned, there's really a handful of that if it's transpired in the last couple of years that have done voluntary reporting. So essentially, the way that the law reads, this tax is already due and it's already on the books. Right, so for the folks that have failed to submit their tax returns and file for that are essentially the ones that are non-compliant. And so the folks that already have, obviously they've conformed to the statutes. That being said, we certainly want the Department of Law to weigh in on an opinion of this as to the extent that this bill passes, if the state has an obligation for anyone that has paid up to this point.
Okay, Representative Sumner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. By my reading of it, there would be no provision for rebates. And in fact, I think the folks that owe the tax would still owe the tax. It's just the department would not be able to go forward and take action against them or collect. I mean, they could, I suppose, still voluntarily remit the tax they owe, but and they would still owe it. It just would not be, there's no provision to collect it then.
Representative Stutz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That makes me very uncomfortable treating people differently. I think, I don't know if this bill needs to be amended to say that people that have paid and get a credit or a rebate or whatever, but you just don't treat people differently like that. That's, for me, that's a problem.
Okay, anybody else? So I think one of the reasons that I'm most interested in this bill is Section 5 because it protects those Alaskans. There was a court case and there was a vehement disagreement between the tax division and the courts and the Turo owners and all that. This bill has been going for 6 years, probably something like that. And I was never very interested in it until two things happened. Turo and the major rental companies came to an agreement, and we protected a bunch of Alaskans that we sort of set up to put in, that we put them in this position because we didn't really have a vehicle for them to pay the taxes. They're supposed to pay the taxes. Turo didn't help. They didn't have a vehicle. So it was this big mess that we created. I'm curious, maybe Mr. Lamani or Mr. Spanos, if you could give me an idea of how many people have actually followed the law and done their due diligence and paid taxes, and how much money we're talking about that they would be sort of getting taken, you know, screwed out of isn't really the word, but I mean, we are kind of penalizing them because we're forgiving a group of people that didn't pay their taxes, and here's a group of people that were good folks and figured out a way to pay their taxes. So I'm wondering, that subset, how big is it, and how much money are we talking about? If one of you has an answer or an idea, even. Yeah, you're muted, Mr. Spanos.
Thank you for that. Mr. Chair, we have done an analysis for that in the past and looked at that internally. I don't have it in front of me at the moment. So we would need to get back to you with the number. It's not a large number, but we can provide the number and the total assessed. There is some manual work that needs to go into that. Our system is pretty robust and can run a great number of reports. But when you file a tax return as a vehicle rental taxpayer, there isn't a question on whether you're an individual or an entity because the system doesn't see any difference between it. It's just, have you rented a vehicle, yes or no? And so we do need to kind of go through manually and try to parse out who might be an individual renting on a platform versus who's maybe just has a small company and renting several vehicles as a vehicle rental owner. So the what I'm getting at is when we provide the information, it may not be 100% accurate, but it's the best that we can get out of our system.
Okay. Representative Sumner.
Thanks. And through the chair, was the department at one point garnishing folks' bank accounts for owed taxes?
Through the chair, Representative Sumner, I believe it was last year or the year before, we did levy bank accounts on, I believe it was two or three taxpayers, yes. And those were reversed because we had received previous direction to stop assessing the tax, which we did, but we failed to go into our compliance portion of our system and turn off the levies.
Representative Vance.
There's a button somewhere.
Thank you. Through the chair, can you help us understand, I mean, like, we're talking about people who are in their non-compliance with paying taxes, but the basic structure of the Toro platform is regular people being able to make their vehicle available for rental. So what is the threshold of number of rentals or how many times it's rented for someone to be considered to have this considered a business enterprise? Because I'm wondering what kind of communication is made with these individuals thinking, oh, I can rent out my car, you know, every other weekend in the summer and make a few extra bucks. Is it being communicated to them that they are indeed acting as a business and that these requirements are now have been placed on them?
Through the chair, if I may.
Mr. Lamani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, we actually have a slide towards the end of our presentation that addresses the IRS requirements as it pertains to the 1099-K and the number of transactions that have to take place and what the dollar limits that were in effect previously in order for someone having to file for the tax return.
So that's kind of a good point. Department of Revenue both have invited testimony and some slides, so maybe we should let those get through.
Further questions.
Yeah, those might answer a lot of our questions. So unless there's any other questions for the sponsor, we will move on to invited testimony. So as you noticed, on Teams we have Department of Revenue Deputy Commissioner Fadil Lamani and Department Tax Director Brandon Spanos. Other invited testimony coming up, Kerrigan Grigsby, Executive Vice President of Avis Alaska, who is on the phone, and Kendall Gaglio, I hope I said that right, from Truro Government Relations. So let's begin with Mr. Lamani, Department of Revenue Deputy Commissioner. Mr. Lamani, I assume that Senator Klayman's staff will be running your slides for you. Is that the way we want it? Perfect.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, and committee members. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to present on SB 127. For the record, my name is Fidel Lamani. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Department of Revenue. And we also have Brandon Spanos, our Acting Tax Director, to be available to the committee for any questions. Looking at slide 3 of the presentation, just as the bill's sponsor has alluded, the primary objective of this legislation is essentially to move the responsibility for collecting and remitting the tax from the individual owners to the vehicle rental platform company. One thing that we want to highlight here that is relatively important is that this is, does not constitute a new tax. This is already an existing tax. And so the proposed legislation provides a streamlined process for the Department of Revenue in being able to collect the peer-to-peer rental tax. This does not only reduce the administrative burden, but also increases the reporting and compliance, where that is currently under the owners of the vehicles. There's two provisions that I want to call your attention to. Number one is AS 4352.010, which provides that there's an imposed excise tax on the charge of a lease or rental of a passenger vehicle in the state if the lease or rental of the passenger vehicle does not exceed a period of 90 consecutive days. And then number two is 4352050, which provides that taxes shall be collected and paid to the department of by the person who provides the lease or rental vehicle. Essentially, as the sort of bottom line that we've highlighted in slide four, is that the tax burden already exists. This is not a new tax. And so this bill compels and enables the vehicle rental platforms to collect the tax at the point of sale and remit that on behalf of the vehicle owners. Just to give you some background on the excise tax on slide five, is that Alaska levies an excise tax on fees and costs charged to the lease or rental of a passenger or recreational vehicle if the lease or rental does not exceed a period of 90 consecutive days. And so looking at the tax rate for passenger vehicles, the current rate is at 10% for recreational vehicles and 3% for renting or leasing that for such as RVs or other vehicles. The vehicle rental lease agencies file the tax returns on a quarterly basis and remit that to the Department of Revenue. As the bill sponsor alluded to, as part of the committee substitute within Senate Finance, there's two provisions that were changed. One, reducing the rate for the vehicle rental platform for ride sharing from 10% to 8%. And then the most important piece, which protects the Alaskans, is from the retroactive assessment that upon immediate approval of the bill, that the Department of Revenue does not have the ability to go retroactively and collect any of those outstanding taxes that have been assessed thus far. Looking at slide seven, this is the legislative history here. Initially, the legislature enacted the vehicle rental tax in 2003 and became in effect in January of 2004. Over the course of the years, there's been changes that have been made to the legislation that essentially exempt some types of vehicles. And the most recently, as Senator Clayman mentioned, in 2020, the municipality of Anchorage passed an ordinance, AO number 2020-55, that essentially established the duties and responsibilities of a rental vehicle hosting platform. Since then, we've seen the revenues for the municipality of Anchorage increase significantly over that time frame, understanding that during the same time frame, COVID was a factor, and so it impacted a lot of the revenues for not only the state as a whole, but also for the municipality of Anchorage. And so looking at the most recent report for 2023, the car rental agencies and the revenues that were collected by the municipality of Anchorage was $152 million for the car rental and about $17 million for the RV rental agencies, which is approximately in total of $170 million. Looking at slide eight is the legal framework. We've covered items one and two on the earlier slides. The other two, which are AS 4423020B, subsection two, which provides that the Attorney General shall, too, under item two, bring, prosecute, and defend all necessary and proper actions in the name of the state for the collections of their revenue. And then number two is AS 4425 0201 and item 2, the Department of Revenue shall 1. Enforce the tax laws of the state, and 2. Collect, account for, have custody of, invest, and manage all state funds and the revenues of the state within certain exceptions of the Alaska Firm Fund Corporation. Look at slide 9. I talked a little bit about this earlier. Recently, the IRS has issued new regulations. So as part of the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021, the threshold for reporting on third-party network transaction, which is also commonly known as Form 1099-K, was reduced to $600 regardless of the number of transactions. And so the IRS has taken a stair-step approach on this one. They've delayed the implementation of the reporting, and so they tend to do it on two phases. The first phase is for tax year 2024. They intend the threshold to be for $5,000, and then for tax year 2025, the threshold would be $600. So in recent year, including tax year 2023, the threshold for reporting of the third-party network transaction was payments totaling more than $20,000 or more than 200 transactions. And so initially when the IRS made the switch was around 2008 under the Housing and Economic Recovery Act. They recognized that they're seeing a lot of activity within third-party network transactions. And so the legislation came into effect in 2011 where they introduced the 1099-K. And so at that point, folks making more than $20,000 and more than 200 transaction required to file the 1099-K. Well, the Department of Treasury and the federal government recognize that perhaps folks are under-reporting on some of these revenue measures, hence why they made the change in 2021 as part of the American Rescue Act to substantiate that that under-reporting or loss of revenue that they otherwise would have been able to recoup. Looking at slide number 10 from a fiscal impact, in recent years, based on what the Department of Revenue has collected on a statewide level, over the last 4 years, we've averaged about $10.7 million in vehicle rental taxes. Alone in 2023, that number was about $15.4 million. And so the proposed legislation were again, capture the unreported vehicle rentals that are arranged and executed through a vehicle rental platform. There would provide a positive effect on revenue to the state. We currently don't have the data and the ability to see what that potential of revenue is because we just don't have the data from the third party or the platform that's hosting the vehicle owners. However, we do know that this would generate a positive revenue. And so addressing one of the questions that was asked a little bit earlier, we currently have approximately $470,000 in delinquent accounts that's spread over 25 taxpayers. That pretty much, Mr. Chair, sums up the presentation that Department of Revenue has, and we're happy to field any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you, Mr. Lamani. Any questions from the committee? Representative Vance.
Thank you, through the chair. How does the department expect to continue reaching compliance? If you don't have an idea how much could be available and how many people there are using these platforms, how do you expect to reach compliance and collect these taxes going forward?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, that's I assume that's with the passage of the bill or where the law is in current form.
Follow up. On the platform itself, does it automatically, is there something that would automatically collect the tax on behalf of the rental owner?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, with the passage of this bill, yes, essentially the host would be able to identify and gather that information and then be able to, on behalf, report that to the Department of Revenue. Currently, we don't have that level of information to be able to understand and to see who is subject to paying for that tax, because we don't have the data. We don't have the ability to subpoena the data, hence why we have the amendment or the language in the legislation to be able to have subpoena power, so that way we're getting that information from the platform.
Mr. Chair, I could add a little more to that.
Senator Klayman.
So the way Turo has proceeded in a number of states, you, depending on which state and whether they passed a law requiring Turo to collect the taxes on behalf of the vehicle owner, because Turo owns no vehicles, in states that have passed laws like this, when you rent from Turo, there's a line on it that says tax, and so it comes on the Turo app. So now today, for example, if you rented in Anchorage on Turo, there'd be a line for the Anchorage tax, but there's no line for the state tax. Turo has obviously the capability within their platform to put that item on the invoice that the renter would pay. And so the way the state would really know through Turo, because this law would require Turo, when they're collecting tax on behalf of the vehicle owner, to add that to the charges at the time of rental. And as part of working on this legislation, whenever I talk to somebody that's rented on Turo out of state, I say, can you send me the receipt? And I see some receipts that have a line for the state tax, and I see other invoices from Turo that don't. And so what that has made it apparent to me is that Turo has the capacity to adjust their app so that it collects the tax. And then that information, as this bill requires, would then get submitted to the Department of Revenue on behalf of the vehicle owner.
Thank you.
Representative McKay.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I want to thank Senator Klayman and everyone who put together this bill. I plan to vote for it. I plan to support it. I think it's very happy that this is finally solved. But I think that Representative Johnson and my colleague from Kodiak bring up a very, very good point that if I had paid taxes according to the law and then another individual that had the exact same operation had not paid the taxes, I'd be a red hot rattlesnake. And I think that just in the name of fairness and the credibility of the state of Alaska, that part of this situation should be addressed either in another bill next session or administratively or somehow. Because, you know, every night I turn on the news and what do we see? Two sets of rules in our country. And that has to end at all levels. We have to treat everyone the same, everyone fairly. So the people that have paid taxes on this, I think they're being kind of punished, and we've got to do something about that. So anyway, Mr. Chairman, thank you for listening to my little rant. I think we need to address that, and I appreciate the time to discuss it. But again, I like the bill. I'll support it. Thanks for bringing it forward.
Mr. Chair, on that topic.
Senator Klayman.
I recognize the chair's intention was to move this today. I have no problem either if you want to hold it another day and we can work on, I would suggest, come up with an amended language for non-statutory language, but in the bill itself that just says either give them credit or pay them the money back. I think one of the challenges the department may have is that in their records, it's not necessarily at all clear who is a Turo renter or who may have a brick and mortar operation that is not Turo.
Right.
But I don't have a problem if you want to hold it for another day or if we want to try to work that as a form, and I'm receptive either one.
Thanks, Representative Sumner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not so sure we should do that because I wonder if there might not be a horizontal equity issue there, similarly situated taxpayers, and then we're going to rebate back the tax that they did indeed owe to some but not all, and could we invalidate our tax that way? I don't know.
Yeah. So, Mr. Lamani, what do you think? I mean,
through the chair, I mean, there's a lot of legal implications here, and just, you know, being a tax professional for many years, you know, the IRS always changes the rules and regulations as it goes through. And in some years, obviously, it benefits certain folks that otherwise didn't
benefit taxpayers in the past. And so being able to go through that process, not only from an administrative standpoint, but also from a legal standpoint, it will expose the state and the department not only for this program, but perhaps other programs as well, that folks can make the argument saying, well, we believe that we should be treated in a certain way. The intent behind this legislation, again, is for the state and the department to move this, to fix this issue moving forward, so that way the individual owners are not having to bear the consequence, the administrative burden. As we talked about the new IRS regulations that they're imposing, essentially we're going to be able to have that data, because that data will get transmitted over to the Department of Revenue. And at that point in time, we have no option but to administer the tax. And because the existing law, that threshold has been 20,000 or more than 200 transaction, so there's been a lot more leeway for the folks that have participated on the platform. And whereas now, when that limit goes significantly lower, we'll have the data and essentially would have to impose that tax no matter what.
Thanks, Mr. Lamani. Fair enough. And I think what I think what I'd like to do with the committee's indulgence, or unless you have any other ideas, is I think we should still focus on moving this bill forward, give the department a chance to come up with how many, what that subset of people is and how many are affected. And then maybe Mr. Rules Chair could give us an idea Wednesday or Friday when it's on the floor. We could put a floor amendment in that we have sort of vetted and talked and agreed that way. Any preference from the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I certainly like to see it move today. I'm not trying to, you know, slow it down at all. I just thought we should point that out, because if I was watching this hearing and I had paid those taxes, I'd be calling my lawyer right now getting ready to, you know, I mean, if it was a significant amount of money.
Right.
I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but, you know, anyway, I've said enough. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Stutz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, through the chair. So this is the last committee of referral?
It is.
Okay. Yeah. I think that the maker of the bill gets the drift and can help us through this if we move it and make sure that it's
right,
fine-tuned. I don't know that that's exactly the right protocol to use, is sending it out knowing that it needs some fixing.
Right.
I have a little angst with that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mina was first.
Thank you, Chair McCabe. To the chair, I defer to the will on the committee on this one. I think there has been a lot of vetting on this bill and a lot of work being done on this bill with the entities involved, from both the rental companies and from the car share companies. I'm curious if there's, and I know less about the history and the background of the rental laws, but in other states where there might have been a discrepancy and lack of collection of taxes of tour owners, do you know if there has been rebates or some similarities in other states?
Through the chair, Representative Mina, we've not looked into that question at all.
Representative Sumner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess one other thing to consider is that the bill, for some reason, has all zero on the fiscal note, although I know I think it says it'd be revenue positive. But if we put some retroactive rebate language in there, it would almost certainly have to then go to finance.
Right.
This would not be the last committee.
And I'm concerned, as you are, with the sort of the secondary effects of trying to, you know, if it's and not taking away from their law-abiding a bit, you know, desires to pay the taxes the way the state wants. But if it's a small, tiny subset of people and a small amount of money, and it does have that leveling of, I just don't know that maybe the what we're trying to do to protect a small subset of people that would have, he could have huge consequences across the board with the with the Department of Revenue and the tax, you know, maybe it's better just to establish a point in time and say, you know, we've been messing with this bill for half a decade at this point, and I think it's time that we need to. And Senator Klayman is, I mean, I commend him for bringing this forward and finding a compromise and finding a path forward that protects Alaskans. And you know, sometimes you just have to triage it a bit and say this is the best we can do.
And Mr. Chair, for clarity, and because my memory, as you've been talking, there is currently a finance referral on the bill after this committee.
Is there?
Yes.
I didn't see that on the bill. Okay. Well, that's that makes it a little bit easier. So, Mr. Lamani, you have a little bit of homework before this hits finance. If we can get an idea of what the subset of those people are, as well as a sort of a tightly defined paragraph on how you think trying to fix their issue will also affect the Department of Revenue and the tax division in the long term. That would be really great.
Mr. Chair, we'll certainly be able to provide that information to the committee, and then also we'll work with the bill sponsor as well as with the Department of Law and look at, from the rebate standpoint, what our options are there.
Okay, very good. So we have another, a couple other folks to testify. So I think first we'll do Kendall Gaglio, Government Relations from Truro. Could you, I understand you're on the phone. Can you put your name on the record and go ahead and begin your testimony?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Honorable Chair and committee members. My name is Kendall Gaglio. Mr. Chair, you did pronounce it correctly. Thank you for that. I'm part of the team at Truro. Truro is a peer-to-peer car sharing marketplace, and I believe the only such marketplace currently operating in the state of Alaska. Our mission is to put the world's 1.5 billion cars to better use. As mentioned by the committee earlier, Truro owns no vehicles. All the vehicles belong to locals who have paid to register their vehicles with the state, as well as any other applicable taxes or fees associated with the vehicle purchase. These hosts, as we refer to them as, they earn extra income by sharing their vehicles with other locals and visitors. And just to share a little bit about the community that's currently benefiting from peer-to-peer car sharing, in our most recent community survey, over half said that they use Truro to ensure they're able to actually make their monthly car payments, followed by covering other primary household expenses and then paying off debt. The majority said they spend these earnings at local businesses in their communities. And in Alaska specifically, nearly 20% of respondents of community members that are using car sharing are military families. Our community members sincerely appreciate Senator Klayman's and his staff, as well as the committee's willingness to work with impacted stakeholders towards a reasonable approach to the collection and remittance of the excise taxes that could be applied to car sharing. We are very encouraged by this most recent version of the bill that removes that threat of retroactivity and establishes an 8% tax for peer-to-peer car sharing while keeping rentals at 10%, seemingly taking into account the differing business models and financial benefits that traditional rental companies benefit from that your constituents using car sharing are not entitled to. As you heard from Senator Klayman and the Department of Revenue, passing this version of the bill will allow for marketplaces like Truro to accurately collect and remit the tax going forward on behalf of the state, you know, seemingly making it easier for everyone. So we really do appreciate your willingness to work with the impacted parties towards a reasonable and fair solution. And we wanted to thank you for your leadership in this effort and even working weekends. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gaglio. Any questions from the committee for the government relations person from Truro? No? Okay, next we're going to go to Kerrigan Grigsby, who is the executive director of Avis Alaska. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Through the chair, hi, this is Kerrigan Grigsby. Appreciate all the time everyone's taking on Saturday. I'm the executive vice president of Avis Alaska. I've been crossing out different parts of my my little spiel here because I don't want to go over and over the same things everyone's been talking about and already understand. So we're one of the largest brick and mortar, if not the largest as far as locations, employees, and fleet in general throughout the state of Alaska. We are a partial employee-owned company, so every single employee that works over 1,000 hours in a year gets a financial stake in the company and a profit-sharing opportunity that basically it's like a 401k that you don't have to actually put any of your own earnings into. So I believe that's an eight-figure number as far as the account for all these employees at this point. A shared account. So we have a very, very vested interest in the state of Alaska and in economies from Fairbanks all the way down to Sitka, Skagway, Juneau, Haines, Kenai, and obviously Anchorage, Kodiak, and I hope I'm not forgetting one, but Whittier in the summer. So, I mean, really what this is about is fairness and at the end of the day, we've all kind of gone round and around on what that means. And we've settled on 8% for the car sharing, Turo apps, and then, 10% rental. And we're in support of that. We're on the record on that. But I just would like to real quick talk on some comments that were made earlier in this committee. The rebating and the idea that going retroactively to give back money would really cause a problem for us and industry on this deal. Because as Representative McCabe stated earlier, we are one of those, I can't remember the term he used for the angry snake, but I mean, we personally as a corporation, Alaska Corporation, pay seven figures every single year to the state of Alaska on behalf of this tax that we collect from our renters. So we personally are in a seven figure every year, over, 50, 60,000 contracts throughout the year, collecting this tax. And so if there was a retroactive rebate for people who followed the law and us being one of the people who followed that law, that would create an administrative nightmare for us. I mean, we wouldn't be able to just keep that. We would have to refund that to each and every customer that has come before us. So, at the end of the day, I mean, I guess I would say we're in full support of the version as is. And again, a huge thank you to Senator Klayman and his staff and everyone that's helped on this and looking forward to moving it on, in the state that it is now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Grigsby. I appreciate that. And, coming from a family that owned rental cars when I was a young man, I totally understand what you're saying. Although we owned Hertz and Avis was always, we're number two, we try harder. But So thank you for your testimony. And I understand your last piece there and exactly what you're saying is the tentacles of attempting to be fair to everybody might be more than we can accomplish through this bill. So it might be, maybe Representative McKay said it right, maybe there should be a separate bill or something that isolates what we're trying to do for those. And if it's a small subset, I don't know. I mean, I agree, I would be furious, but at some point I'd get over it. Because that's what we do. So thank you. So that's it for the invited testimony, unless there's any questions. I do have one person online for public testimony, and I don't see anybody in the room, so maybe I'll do the public testimony and then we'll get Senator Klayman to wrap up and see if there's any questions. All right, very good. So at this point, I'm going to open public testimony, and I see online Claire Holland LeClaire, and you are good to go. Put your name on the record and begin your testimony. You have 3 minutes.
Oh, thank you very much. My name is Claire Holland LeClaire, and I'm a member of the Chugach State Park Citizens Advisory Board. We previously sent a letter to all the members of the Transportation Committee outlining the Chugach State Park Advisory Board's support for SB 127, which would close the Turo loophole, increase vehicle rental tax, and allow more funding to be available to support state parks. There are currently two fund sources for the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation's operating budget, receipts from park fees and receipts from the state's vehicle rental tax. So our intent in supporting this legislation is to increase the state's vehicle rental tax receipts and thereby increase the available funding for maintenance and operations of Alaska's state park system. Public use of state parks, including by independent tourists, has grown significantly without a commensurate increase in operating budgets. Chigach State Park, for instance, experienced a 47% increase in use between 2019 and 2021, and it is Alaska's most visited public recreation destination. And I'll pause there. That's including all federal and state public recreation destinations, Chigach State Park. And there are gems all over our state. We have an incredible state park system. So SB 127 would make sure that the state collects all of these tourism tax dollars to help maintain and operate Alaska's state park system. We believe that adequately staffing our state parks and providing funding for basic needs such as sanitation is necessary for our Alaskans, for our continued enjoyment of our state parks, as well as to preserve and grow the state's tourism and outdoor recreation economy. I thank the committee for your attention and your careful deliberation of this legislation.
So thanks, Ms. LeClaire. Are there any questions from the committee? Thanks for your Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to clarify, you know, for the record and those watching, that the use of these funds is traditional because we cannot have dedicated funds. The legislature does often honor, you know, those uses in the funds, but it is not a hard and fast in law because we can have no dedicated funds. So I just want to make that clear if there's any confusion on this issue, but I don't foresee any change in the use of these funds at this time.
Thank you for that. And Ms. LeClaire, thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone in the room that wants to testify? I don't see anybody else online, so nobody hidden in the room. With that, I will close public testimony. Senator Klayman, any additional comments? And my script here says Senator Klayman to discuss how amazing the bill is and how Alaskans can't live without it. So you must have come in and bought coffee for the office or something this morning.
First, Mr. Chair, I want to say I really appreciate the discussion, including the commentary from Mr. Grigsby and Representative Sumner. And I think in light of those comments, I'm going to say that I think my view in terms of trying to figure out some path for rebates for the what appears to be a small number of people that have paid the tax that is clearly a tax owed today. I think we should do that with great caution, and I think the better path, if we are to try to do that, we should probably, as Representative McKay suggests, look at that as something to maybe look at in a future year, but not as part of this bill, because I think even if we tried to do it in Finance Committee, I think there's enough things going on that I think that raises more challenges than it eliminates. And I certainly recognize that Representative McKay's example of calling the lawyer when the lawyer said, well, that'll be $400 an hour to give you an opinion, they may decide that the taxes are less than the hourly fee. So I'll back off on my earlier comments, but I more than anything, I think because there is that outstanding tax liability today on the Turo owners who, whether they have notice or don't have notice, the state certainly doesn't know who they are. Turo knows who they are. But I think there's a real benefit to consumers that are renting their cars through Turo that we pass this as expeditiously as possible because it does protect them going forward and also ensures that the taxes are collected going forward. And so you know, this is a lot of time with different kinds of car rental vehicle operations, and I appreciate your hearing the bill.
Thank you, Senator Klayman. I don't disagree at all. I think it's long past time that we fix the problem that we sort of created. And so I'm kind of interested in seeing this move forward today. What's the will of the committee? Representative Vance, do you have a motion for me or do you have a question?
I have a question.
Oh, boy.
Well, we have an attorney before us. So through the chair.
Who apparently doesn't know a lot about retroactive tax legislation.
This is not about the retroactive, and because I it gives me a lot more comfort that this is going to finance to give the Department of Revenue and you as a sponsor time to just really put some of this to rest. And this isn't about the retroactivity, but by some of these parties having paid taxes and others by this piece of legislation not being required to do so, are we opening ourselves up for litigation by those who have paid taxes? And is there something that we could put in the language that could help prevent that?
Through the chair, Representative Vance. The discussion that I somewhat lightly made about with Representative McKay's comment about calling his lawyer, the challenge of saying, well, I want to go bring some kind of a action about why didn't you collect the other taxes, that's not easy to find somebody that wants to take that case, and the parties that would have a significant financial interest, which would be companies like Avis in our discussions with those companies has been working on this bill. They've been 100% consistent that if this bill passes, they have no interest in trying to worry about the past. They're looking to move forward. So I've never heard anyone say, if the bill passes, I've never heard anyone that would be in an economic position to be willing to pay the council to do that, say they want to do it. I don't think, and I tend to think that's not something we should try to write into legislation.
Representative Sumner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it's important to point out that it's the renter that pays the tax. The owner is simply required to collect it and then remit it. So it would have to be some enterprising attorney that takes, I guess, a class action on behalf of all renters that, you know, rented through Avis or what have you. And so I don't think, I think we should do it exactly the way that it is in this bill. And to rebate back to the owners of vehicles in Turo, when if they did collect the tax, they collected it from the renter. That is not their money to be rebated back. So I would recommend against that.
Mr. Lamani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to express to the committee the cautionary measures on this area in being able to put anything in statute or perhaps in this bill to address with that, because I really do think that it's going to expose the state to other liabilities, and perhaps it could create an opportunity, for instance, rental car companies to come in and suing the state, which obviously have the biggest burden of that $15 million that I referenced a bit earlier, an annual. It can certainly put that at risk. And so there's a lot of legal statutes, a lot of different cases when it pertains to tax law. And I would advise the committee to tread lightly on this area and not put the state in a precarious situation when it comes to tax liability. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Lamani. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to make sure that this conversation was well established on the record, that we are not wanting to put the state in any position of liability, and that we're trying to do what's best for Alaskans and really all parties involved. So I appreciate the indulgence on that question.
Thank you. Representative McKay.
Mr. Chairman, I will just say for the record that I represent my constituents and the people of Alaska. And if we put the state of Alaska in a precarious situation, that's a secondary concern for me. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I think we beat this one to death. Representative Vance.
I move CSSB 127 work order LS-0635 /R from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Okay, seeing no objection, SB 127 is moved from the House Transportation Committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the committee report. Okay, back on the record, House Transportation Committee. Next on our agenda will be HB 233. This is our second hearing on this bill. Today we will take up amendments and hear public testimony. So amendment number one is labeled 33-LS1042/A.2 by myself. So I move amendment number one.
Object. Purposes of discussion.
Thank you. So I'll explain my amendment. This amendment aims to synchronize the rates and time allowances for manufacturers and dealers, aligning them with widely recognized independent labor time guides like Chilton's, All Data, or ProDemand, which are commonly used across the industry. So what that does is, instead of using what the manufacturers say, we're using an independent group that says, hey, it takes 29 hours to change an engine on a Ram 1500. So in some of the discussions I've had with mechanic friends of mine and that work at some of the dealers, I think the dealer pays, or the manufacturer pays, 9 hours to change an engine on a Ram 1500. One of my friends who works in a Dodge dealer says that it took two of them, experienced technicians working together, 12 hours is the best they could do to change an engine. So there is a disparity there that needs to be fixed. And part of the issue is not necessarily the manufacturer's fault. It's that we got involved with this 6 years ago or so, and we didn't completely solve it. I think our direction to the manufacturers and the dealers was, go stand in the corner until you can play nice with each other. And maybe it's time to fix this. So if the manufacturers can't or won't see their way towards helping out the people that help them the most, the people that sell their product, then perhaps we need to be a little bit more prescriptive. So that's my amendment, and I'm open to any discussion, and hopefully the rest of our team will be back shortly. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair McCabe. Could you just walk through again the amendment and how it changes what's currently in the bill?
Sure. So all this does is establish or require that they use an outside, nonpartisan, if you will, guide for the amount of time it takes for them to do a project. So oftentimes the manufacturers, as we heard in testimony, the last time we heard this bill, the manufacturers say it takes 1.5 hours to do something, when they don't include the time to bring the car in, clean it out with a high pressure sprayer, put it up on the lift. And some of the disparity that I've heard, in particular, we heard about working on an air conditioning compressor, and they were paid an hour for something that they know takes 90 minutes, and that's refilling the air compressor. So why are we just paying an hour for something that scientifically that they know takes 90 minutes? So there is a huge disparity there. I wish they could solve it by themselves, but apparently they can't. And we gave them 6 years supposedly to work on this. So now we're going to have to do something because they can't hire employees. I have several mechanic friends, and they won't work for a dealer anymore. They just won't, because of this problem. So I don't know if we should allow the free market the time that it would take to solve this, which would mean essentially everybody, there wouldn't be any dealers in Alaska anymore. You can see the number of dealers that have been shut down, and it's because they can't find mechanics. They can't find people to work on the cars, and people won't buy a car if they can't get it worked on. So anyways, that answer your question?
It does. Thank you.
Representative Stutz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a good amendment. I was here 6 years ago when this issue was addressed. It was agreed upon by the manufacturers and the dealers that they would address this issue. If we could just get the bill through 6 years ago and set this portion aside, they agreed they'd come together, and there's been no movement on the part of the manufacturers. So I agree with you. If they're not going to do it, let's do it.
No, it's one.
Ask another question.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair McCabe. To the chair, I'm wondering if we could get an opinion from the bill sponsor in this chamber or in the other chamber on this amendment.
Sure. I think Representative Tomaszewski's not here, but his staff, David Goff, is. So if you'd like to come to the table and put yourself on record and give us your opinion, Mr. Goff, that'd be great.
David Goff, for the record, staff of Representative Tomaszewski. I think that this is a good amendment to put some clarification on what is going to be used or the standards that are going to be used to develop that, so you don't have independent shops setting their own hours and saying that they're a national standard. This way you got something you can go back to and develop a criteria for setting those hours.
So there has been some talking again to, I have a bunch of friends that are mechanics, but talking to some of my mechanics friends, there is a workaround that some of the dealers are using where they will use an independent shop to do this. Problem is it voids the warranty oftentimes because an independent shop isn't necessarily a factory trained certified mechanic, you know, so there's all this sort of fluctuation out there, and I really wish they had been able to find a way to talk to each other. Because frankly, the manufacturers need the dealers to sell their product. So any other discussion on Amendment 1? Representative Sumner, you look confused.
I'm just reading it, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All it does is allow or require that the manufacturers and the dealers use an outside estimator for the work done, like Chilton's or the three manuals mentioned in there. And it gives a sort of an independent, this is how long it actually takes when you're in the field or when you're not in the manufacturer's clean, nice clean shop with a brand new car, when you, especially in some cases where they haven't, they extended the warranty because of a recall or an issue or a problem that they had. So now instead of working on a 2-year-old truck, you're working on a 10-year-old truck that's all rusty and nasty, and you break bolts off, and it just takes frankly longer. So obviously, I get the manufacturer's idea that some mechanics are faster than others, and it's up to the dealers to put their best mechanics in for the best job that's going to do it the fastest. But there's issues on both sides. I get that. But we, as Representative Stute said, we should have solved this 6 years ago.
I have another question.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair McCabe. Through the chair, perhaps to either of the bill sponsors, for the four plus other states that have passed this law, have they also just required reimbursement based on independent time guides only and not from the manufacturer time guides?
For the record, David Goff from Representative Tomaszewski's office, through the chair to Representative Mina. I've not done any research to see if they had a set criteria, but that was the standard that we were being referred to each time, was these independent books that were out there. Chilton's is one of them. There were several others that were listed there as well on our sheet from last week when we presented the first time.
So just sort of to follow up on that, Chilton's is a totally independent. They're not associated with any manufacturer. All three of these books are independent, and they're provided to independent shops as a way to estimate, hey, a brake job on a 2014 Ford Escape should take this long. And that's what you quote the customer. And it's industry practice in lots of businesses when you make an estimate, I'm sure. Those of us that build homes have a set way that they estimate how much a home is, whether it's by square foot or whether it's by number of corners or number of weird structural deals or whatever. They all kind of have a set estimate. Estimating is almost an art, even with cars these days. So it's important to have it sort of an independent person estimating those, I believe. So that was sort of the genesis of this amendment.
May I ask a follow-up?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Through the chair, either to the sponsor or if anybody else knows, I know that in testimony and some of the documents, a lot of the frustration with the manufacturer time guides is that tax can only meet the time 50%+ of the time when they actually test them. What's that success rate for the independent time guides, like with the children?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. That's actually, I mean, we could certainly find that out. And I think we do have Mr. Nichols online. He's the president of the Alaska Auto Dealers Association, and maybe it'd be worth asking that question to him and see if he has an idea on that. Mm-hmm. So, Mr. Nichols, if you are on the line, maybe you could put your name on the record and take a stab at that one.
Sure, Les Nichols, NICHOLS, president of the Alaska Auto Dealers Association. Through the chair, if you don't mind, could you repeat that question so I have it fresh again, please?
Yes. Through the chair to Mr. Nichols, I've heard that the manufacturer time guides, when they do the testing, techs can only meet the time requirements at least 50% of the time. What is that success rate for the independent time guides? And I know it can vary depending on the repair order.
Through the chair, Representative Mina. So that version of the testimony comes from the manufacturers. They state that the technicians can accomplish those times 50% of the time, which, you know, in most cases, as a former school teacher, I can tell you 50% is enough. However, our membership did similar comparisons, and they found that they could only get 2 out of 100 or 2 out of 75, I forget the exact number, to meet that time. So the manufacturer's representation of 50% of the time is a lot more sunshiny, although still glaringly failing in relation to what the membership and the Alaska Auto Dealers Association had reported back to the Senate and the representatives. So when it comes to the independent labor time guide, I can tell you that I don't have a statistic that will clearly answer that question. And a lot of that is because there's a wide variety of skill levels within the industry. So if you have a technician that's fairly new and knows the steps, but it's not clear, maybe he's not using the fasted method or she is not using the fasted methods, even with the independent time guides, very likely that they are not going to hit those times. But what we're looking for in those times is something that is first achievable at all, and then second achievable through a greater section of the skill levels of mechanics. So you guys heard testimony from Mr. Kincaid, who is a master technician for a Chrysler dealer. And when he talks about that engine job, what he said was that he can do that in about 25 hours. The independent guide says 29 hours, so he actually beats that time. However, he's a 20-year professional with exceptional training background, and he has a great reputation as a mechanic. He is an exceptional mechanic. When you take somebody that's maybe in the middle of the career, they're not going to hit that number. So, but we do feel like that the independent guides are much more realistic in terms of what should be expected of your average mechanic as compared to the manufacturer's guides, which don't seem to be achievable by even the best mechanics that we have.
Thank you.
Any other questions on Amendment 1?
I remove my objection.
Any other objections? Okay, without further objection, Amendment 1 is adopted. Now we have Amendment 2. Where did that go? There it is. Representative Vance.
Mr. Chairman, I move Amendment Number 2.
And I'll object for discussion purposes. Representative Vance.
If I would like to have Mr. Goff speak to this, but the main meat of this is on page 2, and it is the bolded lines that, based upon public testimony. They had spoken on how some of the manufacturers will be punitive against states that pass this law. And we've seen that already in the past with Alaska, where we have higher shipping costs or different things like that. And I wanted to make sure that this wasn't happening, because as Representative McKay mentioned before, our first duty is to protect Alaskans. And I don't want to see any punitive fees imposed on us. And so this lists the separate surcharges, administrative fees, or other similar costs on the new motor vehicle dealer. But if Mr. Goff could explain this further and the impacts that it could make, that would be helpful.
For the record, David Goff, staff of Representative Tomaszewski. Yes, we heard that same testimony, and we are looking at this. We know that there are many other states that have put in this addition to their law, because they were stated that they would raise the prices for that particular state. And so what we're asking is that we understand there's going to be there's going to be increases on that last line. It says manufacturer from increasing the price of a new motor vehicle or changing a schedule of compensation in the ordinary course of business is okay, but not singling out the state of Alaska for additional charges for the customers through the manufacturer to the dealer. And so we're trying to eliminate that by putting this in. This is very similar to the legislation that was passed by the state of Arizona.
Okay. Any other questions on Amendment 2? So,
you made the objection.
Yeah, thanks. I removed my objection. Okay. So we do have an objection for Amendment 2. Would the recorder please call the roll?
Representative Nina?
Yes.
Representative Sumner?
No.
Representative C. Johnson?
Yes.
Representative McKay?
Yes.
Representative Vance?
Yes.
Representative Stoops?
Yes.
Chair McKay?
Yes.
That's 6 yeas, 1 nay.
So on a vote of 6 yeas and 1 nay, Amendment number 2 has passed. Okay, so I know we had a very short time for drafted amendments, but I do have some conceptual amendment forms. If anyone has any conceptual amendments, I want to be sure that everyone has a chance to get their amendments in, especially since we're moving so fast at the end of the session. Anyone? Bueller?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I do think Amendment number one was an improvement, but I do wonder how the which independent labor time guide will be selected, or what the process would be for the selection of that, or would it just be any independent time guide? So it would be the highest one that is available, or I'm a little confused as to how that amendment will actually function.
So, yeah, thanks. So we tried to find a way through that. I mentioned one. I suspect that the manufacturers and the dealers will have to come to an agreement on which one they're going to use. I could have been prescriptive and put that in there. I could have said maybe we do an average of all three. As deep as I got into it, it became overly complicated. So my idea, once again, is to set something up there and let them fight it out over which one they are going to use. And I think there's three major ones that are sort of industry accepted.
Okay. So just to clarify, Mr. Chair, your intention is that in their contracts they would designate by agreement of both parties an independent time
right.
guide. Okay. I have no objections, no concerns okay. for amendments.
No other amendments? Any other discussion? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And maybe I missed a meeting. I don't think I did. But it seems like the testimony we received has been very one-sided. We haven't heard a lot from the manufacturers. I mean, there's two sides of the story, or this would have been solved a long time ago. So I'm a little concerned we haven't heard both sides of the story. I don't know if we have, I don't know what the intention is or anything else, but I'm a little, there's a big blank in here about why has there been a problem, because all we've heard is one side. And once again, if the manufacturers don't have a problem or don't want to show up, then they don't feel they have a dog in the fight, then that's one thing. But if they have not had an opportunity, that's something quite different. So I'm just curious about why the manufacturers haven't been more active in this.
Right. And so that's my fault. I didn't really say it at the beginning, and I should have, is we have 12-ish people online, and most of them are manufacturers for public testimony.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That helps a lot.
So, Representative Stutz.
Thank you. Just along that line, if I could add, I know that the manufacturers were here in the building, and their only position is you shouldn't be getting involved between a manufacturer and a dealership. But yet 6 years ago, it was the manufacturers that came to the state asking us to get involved.
And I, you know, I completely agree with that. We shouldn't be in the middle of this. However, we got in the middle of it 6 years ago, and we didn't provide the complete solution, apparently, or maybe our solution wasn't heeded or wasn't good enough. So, Representative Sumner.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to say that we had heard substantial testimony from the manufacturers in labor and commerce, but it sounds like they're also on the line here.
Right. So. Okay. So with that, if no other questions, I think I will open the floor for public testimony. Is there anybody in the room that wants to give public testimony? Seeing none, what I think I'll do for the moderator's information is I'm going to go to all of those that say self first, because we have a lot of written testimony from manufacturers, and I'm going to give those who haven't written in a chance to talk first. So the very first one is Andrew Stritz from Fairbanks. Andrew, if you'd put your name on the record and begin your testimony, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you for hearing my testimony today. My name is Andrew Stritz, service advisor at Jeans Chrysler here in Fairbanks. I've heard service managers, service directors, and technicians speak on this bill. One thing I wanted to bring up regarding this bill is technician retention and how this bill will help. See, many technicians come and go with the reason that they're unhappy with the times that the manufacturer pays the technician for the time of the repair. The bill not only affects the technician, but it also affects us service advisors. With having technicians leaving, I now have to find time for another technician that's qualified in that particular repair to complete that repair. It adds more workload on that technician, but it also negatively impacts my paycheck as well for that paid period. My position is not an hourly position. I sell repairs not only to people off the street, but to the manufacturers too. Seeing the day-to-day operations, I personally see what technicians get approved from the manufacturer warranty, and also seeing third-party service contracts, seeing what they approve, you know, for our repairs as well. Third-party service contracts use the same exact labor guides that I would use, you know, to someone off the street. Now, those companies are penny pinchers. They send out inspectors, make sure that they're money is going to where it's supposed to go. Now, it's not fair to my technician to, you know, get shorted out by the manufacturer and a service contract who, you know, has no deal with this, you know, manufacturer, and, you know, they get to use our labor time as well. But that's all I have.
Okay, thank you so much, Mr. Streitz. Next, we're going to go to Jade Kincaid. Could you please put your name on the record and begin your testimony at 3 minutes?
For the record, my name is Jade Kincaid. I'm calling in support of House Bill 233. I'm new in my career as a technician, so my experience is shorter than most testifying today. It is no different. The huge difference between warranty times and third-party time studies is extremely discouraging for me personally. The difficulty to get even close to the warranty times given by the manufacturer put unneeded stress and is extremely physically taxing. It is beyond frustrating to constantly fail at meeting the times set forth by the manufacturer despite going through the provided manufacturer training. The benefits for me personally if House Bill 233 passes would afford me as a technician and Alaskan to further progress in this field and have a better quality of life by compensating technicians for our time in a fair and equal way. I want to thank you for your time and your support to both House Bill 233 and your Alaskan constituents.
Thank you so much, Ms. Kincaid. I appreciate your testimony. Next, we have William Simmons. Please place your name on the record and begin your testimony. You have 3 minutes.
My name is William Simmons, calling in support of House Bill 233. I'm a flat rate tech of 1.5 years. I work about 6 days a week, and I average about 75 hours of pay period. I'm the lead transmission tech at Jeans Chrysler. I have obtained all the manufacturer training. I'm fairly new in my career as a dealer tech. With the manufacturer pay scale, I hit those times about 0% of the time. With the third-party contract and labor time guides, I'm at about 80 to 90%. It's quite discouraging and is very taxing on my motivation to continue in a dealer setting. I'm not asking for a handout, just simply asking for proper compensation for my labor. I'd like to thank you for your time and to have your support for House Bill 233 and your Alaskan constituents.
Thank you, Mr. Simmons. I appreciate your testimony. Next, we have Philip Ginter. Please place your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Philip Ginter. I'm calling in support of House Bill 233. I'm a lead tech at a dealer shop in Fairbanks with 10 years experience in the field and nearly 5 years in Alaska. I support this bill due to the positive effects it would have on my coworkers and our customers, the Alaskan consumers. Due to the significantly less amount of time warranty jobs pay, I have technicians in my shop who are reluctant or choosing not to be sent out to manufacturer training to be able to perform warranty repairs, as they know that they can make more money performing the same repairs on vehicles out of warranty. This puts added stress on myself and my other techs who are certified for warranty repairs. Apart from personal stress, I'm scheduled out till August currently. This backlog causes an unnecessary burden on our Alaskan consumer as they have to arrange alternative transportation for months simply because their vehicle is covered under warranty. In addition to that, I feel the lower times for warranty work place technicians in very stressful positions to make time on jobs, not lose money trying to keep up with manufacturers' published times, all while performing a job perfectly. Any mistakes on these jobs can result in something as simple as a leak or an unpleasant noise, all the way to injuries and death. Personally, I believe intensive repairs should not be rushed simply to keep up with the clock. With this bill passed, this will encourage more techs who already perform good work to complete training and perform work they feel are being compensated fairly for, reduce the stress of technicians, and reduce the backlog of work, overall improving the experience of the Alaskan consumer. Thank you for your time, and thank you for your support for this bill and your Alaskan constituents.
Thank you, Mr. Ginter. We appreciate you taking the time on a Saturday to provide your testimony. Next, we have Lucas Kincaid. Mr. Kincaid, please place your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, Mr. Chair. My name is Lucas Kincaid for the record. I'm a master technician at Jeans Chrysler for the past 13, 14 years. I'm in support of this bill, as you've seen me down there multiple times. We've been operating on two sets of rules for too long. You know, the manufacturer are allowed to charge what they want when the national industry standard is already set. I think we should even the playing field and operate fairly without operating on two sets of rules and just agree that the manufacturer can pay the same as the Alaskan consumers pay. One example of that, as you've heard, is that engine job on a 2020 Ram 1500. You know, the industry standard says it's 29 hours to do that job, but the manufacturer says that somehow, some way, I'm supposed to finish it in 9 hours. You know, real-world time, it takes 25 to 26 hours to do that, and even with two fully trained certified technicians, the best it can be done is about 12 hours. You know, another great example of that is the 2022 to the 2024 Jeep Wrangler. You know, it has a 2-liter engine. They say that you can remove and replace that engine in 9.9 hours. Another variant of that is the 2022 Jeep Wrangler 4xe. So that's a partial hybrid vehicle. To do an engine in that requires 22 additional steps, plus the you know, touching the wrong thing at the wrong time, you're dead. That's a hybrid. You know, they say I should be able to do that in 9.9 hours. So why do I have additional steps when these times are scientifically gathered, you know, and they say that a vehicle with 22 extra steps pays the same amount as a vehicle without 22 extra steps, let alone the fact that, you know, if I'm working on a hybrid, I have to have another person standing there with a 12-foot pole. So if I touch the wrong thing, he can pull my corpse off that vehicle. The manufacturer, they don't compensate for this guy that's going to remove my dead body from this car. You know, it's time for the manufacturer to be held to the same standard as the elastic constituents. I thank you for your time, and thank you for your support.
Thank you, Mr. Kincaid. We appreciate you taking your time on a Saturday to provide your testimony. So, Susan Kerrigan-Grigsby, which was on the last one, would also like to testify. Let's get him done, and then we'll move to the manufacturers. So, Mr. Grigsby, if you can hear me, go ahead and place your name on the record and begin your testimony on HB 233.
Yeah, I was just having so much fun, I wanted to hang around. So I really appreciate your time, and I'm going to keep it short. There's far more people that understand this subject than I do. I want to give an anecdotal from a fleet owner of over 2,000 cars throughout the state. This bill will help us get cars back on the road faster. There's a lot of different things that I could kind of point out, or I mean, anecdotal evidence of, but in reality, when a recall happens, a safety recall happens, kind of like the Takata airbag is what most people can, who outside of the industry can really relate with. There's actually, you know, thousands of recalls a year on all the different manufacturers. And as a rental car company, within 24 hours, we have to get that car off of the road. And we're not allowed to rent it until the recall work is performed. Now, a growing percentage of that number is a what's called a no remedy. So basically, they understand the problem, they don't understand the solution, they're coming up with it. And we're basically left holding the bag on that one. But then when a remedy is figured out, whether it's parts or software or whatever has to be fixed, that the what's allotted as far as the hours that the labor is paid, you know, it's going to have an effect on if you've got 50 of these, you know, we buy a lot of the same thing. So if I've got 75 RAV4s of a model year, and they've got to all go through the same shop, and let's say half of them are you know, outside of Anchorage, And we gotta ship them in. There's just the logistics of it really mess with our operation, and it messes with the actual pricing of rental cars out there, because the more you're taking out of the market, the higher that price is going to go for the consumer. So we're in full support of this. I'll step back. Thank you again for your time, and appreciate all your work.
Thank you, Mr. Grigsby. So next we'll go to David Bright, Senior Attorney, Alliance for Automotive Innovation, calling us from Washington, D.C. Mr. Bright, please put your name on the record and begin your testimony. You have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Bright, Senior Attorney at the Alliance for Automotive Innovation. We're the trade association that represents automobile manufacturers, as well as component suppliers and automotive technology. As we've said previously, we are confident that our time guides are accurate. And we have manufacturer representatives who will testify in more detail about how those guides are developed. Again, we're confident that the guides and the processes we have work. And that's why we drafted compromises to put into the Alaska franchise law to reflect those. One compromise we offered said that dealers can request overages, and the manufacturer would bear the burden of proof to show a reason to deny the request. We again put our money where our mouth is. We drafted a compromise. The burden of proof on the manufacturer to show a reason to object to dealer's request to change the time guide itself if it feels that the time allowance is wrong. We offered another compromise to just let dealers send in their time card. We pay the actual time spent. So no more arguing about which time guide is better, which one's more accurate. No more arguing about whether one side is discounting time or the other side is padding hours.
We had hoped one of those compromises would be successful, but unfortunately they were not. But it's the key in all of this. Our concern is paying for the actual number of hours worked in the car. The other side wants to be paid for the number of hours in a book, regardless of how many hours were actually worked. Let me repeat. This bill requires payment for hours that were not worked. Now, I'll make one last point before my time runs out. We've submitted that manufacturer time guides are good and there's no problem. And if you disagree with that, that's fine. But the solution is not an aftermarket time guide, because there's several of them, and they all have varying times for the same repair. For example, one aftermarket time guide says the time to remove and replace a lower radiator shutter was 2 hours. Another said it was 4.4 hours. It's 120% difference. Those guides aren't reliable because they do not do the repairs. They're just estimates. It shouldn't be used for warranty work because they aren't meant for warranty work. And an executive from one of those publishers actually said as much in a written affidavit. He said that his guide is not intended as a substitute for factory warranty time guides. He said his guide is, quote, designed for the typical independent repair shop mechanic who has not been specially trained by a manufacturer, does not necessarily have all the factory-approved tools and diagnostic equipment, and typically works on a broad range of post-warranty vehicles for multiple brands. So this bill is going to result in charges for hours not worked because it requires payment under flat rate guides meant for a different audience and for a different purpose. In theory, this bill is about paying technicians better, and I'll point out that not a single word in it requires technicians to get paid more compensation. And I'm not going to speculate about what would or wouldn't happen if this bill passes, but if you're wondering how it will play out, you may want to consider that the mechanics union that helps dealers push a similar time guide bill in Illinois went on strike shortly after the bill was enacted because they didn't get the pay bump they thought they were going to get from that bill, and that bill was also silent from technician pay. I'll conclude by saying that manufacturers and dealers need each other to succeed. We like our dealers. We depend upon our dealers. We have been and continue to be successful together. This bill, unfortunately, will not help that. You'll be hearing from other witnesses today, as I said, who are closely involved in the manufacturing process and the warranty time guide process. We would respectfully ask this committee to hold the bill. Thank you again for the time this afternoon, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bright. I might point out that in this bill, Section 2, Line 10, page 1 says, unless otherwise agreed to by the manufacturer and the new motor vehicle dealer. So I think it opens the door for you guys to talk. I appreciate your testimony on a Saturday afternoon, I guess, in D.C. Next, we'll go to Dan Carter, Manager, Labor Time Facility, General Motors. Mr. Carter, please put your name on the record and begin your testimony. You have 3 minutes.
Thanks. Good afternoon, Chair McCabe and members of the committee. My name is Dan Carter from General Motors, and I run our labor time facility, and I'm speaking in opposition of HB 233. I will explain how labor times are developed by General Motors and then touch on third-party estimating companies and their impact. We have a 50,000-square-foot facility, a fleet of vehicles, technicians with experience in dealerships and or the independent. We have brought dealer technicians and state-level dealer associations through the facility to show them our process. And they have commented on how much we are set up like a dealership. It is not a perfect lab environment or just someone sitting behind a computer. We perform the repairs. We time the steps. We include allowances for real world and develop fair labor times to compensate the dealer for vehicle repairs. After dealer technicians have visited and seen how we develop times, they have commented that our process is fair, and I can send you video proof of just that. But now, why are third-party time guides hired? That's a simple one, right? They take our times and they add to them. They do not perform studies to the depth we do. They are partisan, and they want to sell the product to dealers and the aftermarket. The practice of adding time is driving our industry to expect to bill more hours to customers than time spent actually repairing the customer's car. Are we okay with consumers being charged four and a half, five hours for a repair we spent 3 hours doing? There was the example we like to talk about 29 hours versus 9 hours. And that the technician would make $900 more. Well, let's complete that story. and think about the consumer who is being charged these third-party times. At $150 retail rate, that job jumps from $1,350 to $4,350, a $3,000 increase. We argued that the tech would get $700 of that. Well, the dealer gets $2,300 of that. And there's no additional cost or overhead for that increase. But even a bigger question is, what did the Alaskan consumer get? All right. Are we following the Alaskan State Automobile? Are we following the Alaska Automobile Repair Act that states a shop may not misrepresent the cost of repairs that have been made? Billing 29 hours for a 9-hour job, even billing 29 hours for a 24-hour job, that's still misrepresenting 5 hours of labor. Even if we get down to 4 hours on a 3-hour job. I guess my question is, are third-party time guys right just because they're more? Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. And again, I'd also point you to Section 2 of the bill, Line 10. Otherwise, unless otherwise agreed to by the manufacturer and the new motor vehicle dealer. Next we have, I'm sorry, Representative Mina. You have a question?
I do, actually.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair to Mr. Carter, thank you for your testimony. When you stated that you include allowances for real-world factors, could you explain more about those real-world factors?
Sure. So when we get done timing all the steps, the last thing we do for our time specifically, and it's published in our service information, is we add a 21% factor to it. So that factor can be anything from going to the parts counter to get parts, running to get special tools. Maybe you've got some dirt underneath the vehicle, you got to get cleared out. Maybe there's some variation. There's a lot of things in that number, but that's what we add that kind of portion.
May I ask a follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair to Mr. Carter, a lot of the testimony that we've received was concerns related to factors that are specific to Alaska, especially our cold weather conditions that impact a lot of cars. Are any of those factors integrated in your real-world considerations, or is it just a 21% increase?
Well, I think there's a lot of factors everywhere, right? I mean, there's mining in Utah where vehicles come in and get covered. There's a heat soak in Arizona. So, I mean, those factors are in there. There's nothing specific to Alaska, but there's obviously factors in all kinds of different states.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Carter. We have about 10 minutes left, and I have five people to get through. So, next is Mr. Chris Gilker, Technical Support, Volkswagen America.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chris Gilker, and I'm employed by Volkswagen of America in the field of technical support. So my team and I work with our Volkswagen technicians on a daily basis. We support 358 dealers with over 1,500 Volkswagen techs. On Thursday's testimony, Mr. Nichols stated the people representing these organizations have no idea how long it takes because they are not mechanics. I was a technician for 6 years in the aftermarket and 6 years at a Volkswagen dealership in Burlington, Vermont. So, yes, I can speak to the topic and state on record that I rarely lost time performing Volkswagen warranty repairs. Yeah, there was one task I couldn't beat that I did on a regular basis. It was a Jetta headliner, and it still haunts me to this day. So, and I averaged 100%, 120% efficiency on warranty work over it. So, basically, if I worked 40 hours, the dealer would bill Volkswagen 50-plus hours. The warranty labor ops established by Volkswagen are very similar to how GM does it. There's a technician that performs a repair three times using only hand tools, where dealer technicians use air and electric tools, which it speeds up the repair, and then they take the average. If, as just happened this past week with an airbag-related recall that Volkswagen's got going on, the technicians find they are losing time on the repair. An adjustment will be made based on the feedback submitted by technicians via the Volkswagen repair manual. It's very easy to do. They went in the manual. They said, hey, this is not enough. This is why. And the National Dealer Service Council pushed it up on their end as well. Volkswagen said, yeah, you're right. We're going to adjust it accordingly. Now, aftermarket labor estimating guides were mentioned. I think, you know, we've gone over these pretty effectively. These guides are established for the average technician, average training, average equipment, versus our dealers who have very specific training tools and equipment needed to perform their repair properly the first time. Third-party labor guides, they also let the repair facility adjust time as needed. So, you know, my question is, how high will times go? Because, you know, if they keep going up, the consumer outside the warranty is going to end up paying even more than they do now. The testimony heard also suggested more money from the manufacturer will help solve the current technician shortage. Yep, money is a factor. It's not the main reason. Digital Dealer and Industry Publication has an excellent article on this topic. You know, lack of a clear career path forward. Being a technician, there's a massive investment in tools, you know, $30,000 and up. I got a great set in my basement. And long hours with required weekends and reduced time off, they're some of the main drivers. So really, the bottom line is this to me, increases in the labor reimbursement for warranty-related repairs, ultimately, they're going to hurt the Alaska consumer. So, you know, thank you very much for your time, and I'm available for any follow-up questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gilker. Representative Sumner has a question.
Thank you, and through the chair, I don't know much about the dealer-manufacturer-franchise relationship, but is there customarily any sort of franchise fees or advertising spend requirement or anything of the sort? And I ask because I wonder if Amendment Number 2 might interfere with some of that.
Oh, thank you for the question, and through the chair, I will fully admit that's really outside my area of expertise. I'm really more in the technical support, working with technicians, and I don't have much to do with the marketing and network side of the business. So I do apologize. I don't have an answer for that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Gilker. I would point out that the Alaska consumer is already being hurt because we have dealers that are closing down in a fairly rapid clip because they can't keep mechanics and because they can't make enough money. When I was growing up in the field, 51% of your profit came out of your shop, and that's just not happening anymore. And a lot of it is because of the inability to keep mechanics that are willing to work on warranty work. So next we have Jeffrey Harbaugh, Customer Service Operations Manager, Portland Region, Toyota.
Good afternoon, Chair McCabe and members of the committee. My name is Jeffrey Harbaugh. I'm the Customer Service Operations Manager for Toyota's Portland Region, which includes Alaska. And I've had the pleasure of meeting with a couple of you during my visit to Juneau earlier this month. It's nice to be before you once again. I have been with Toyota for over 40 years. I started as a technician myself and became a Toyota Master Certified Technician. And now I have the responsibility of overseeing the customer and technical services, which includes warranty administration, policies and procedures, technical support, and technical training. And, you know, thank you for the opportunity to comment on this bill. And we recognize that dealers are concerned about the fairness of warranty reimbursement allowance. And I think that also varies from manufacturer to manufacturer. And so I can only really speak for Toyota. We do have district parts and service managers as well as fuel technical specialists who call on our three Toyota dealerships on a monthly basis. As well, we have warranty hotline and technical assistance, and we, you know, provide support on an ongoing basis. And if push comes to shove, on a rare occasion that the problems can't be addressed, you know, at that level, then that's where I get involved. And I will tell you that 9 times out of 10, Toyota approves the additional pay that a dealership is requesting for whatever reason, whether it has to do with the actual time allowance based on the flat rate times published, or maybe, you know, the additional circumstances that might come up with having to do with cold weather, driving conditions, and all those kinds of things. So I definitely, you know, I want to make sure that you understand that Toyota is confident with our time guides and the accuracy, similar to what's already been stated. We go through the testing and know that the aftermarket manuals just take our time tests and add on to them, and it's usually a multiplier, you know, of 1.4, 1.5, and so on. We want to make sure that our dealers are successful in selling cars in Alaska, and you know, that they keep the customers coming back to their dealerships for service, you know, to support the idea that you know, the sales department sells the first one, but the service brings them back and, you know, continues to generate revenue for the dealerships. And in our case, for Toyota, the warranty work is only 8% of the total repair work that's done in a dealership. So it's a very small portion. And we work very hard to, with our dealers and our, as business partners, to, you know, take care of them and get that customer's vehicle back on the road. And, you know, we have the philosophy of a customer first. And if time permits, I'm available for any questions. If not, thank you so much for your time and attention.
Thank you, Mr. Harbaugh. I appreciate your testimony on this Saturday afternoon. Next, we have Thomas Lawson, Government Affairs Manager, Ford Motor Company. Mr. Lawson, please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Thomas Lawson. I'm the Government Affairs Regional Manager for Ford Motor Company. And I'm calling in today on the Saturday afternoon to voice my opposition, our company's opposition to HB 233. You know, we really believe that this bill improperly ties the amount of compensation manufacturers pay dealers for warranty service to aftermarket labor time guides. And we think that those aren't relevant and they're not intended for repairs performed at a franchise dealership. I'd also like to underscore and you know, agree with the comments that there's nothing in this bill that guarantees higher wages for technicians. I think the other thing that I would want to point out that's a little bit more Ford specific, because the question has come up a few times. You know, once we develop a, you know, a labor time guide, we have several time allowances that are added to that particular time. Some of them are actual time. There's a 20% tech allowance, which allows for them to use a bathroom, take breaks, deal with other things that they need to do, like someone said, like get dirt from underneath the car to be able to get to it, that type of thing. There's also a parts allowance, which can go up to 66 minutes and additional time. There's some issues with a part. And we also have a fastener allowance, which allows for, you know, rusted bolt, broken bolt, and probably in Alaska's case, frozen bolt. You know, so those things are all taken into account and added to that particular time. So it's not just, you know, hey, you know, you need to do this time because this is the time that we did it. You know, we do perform those in a way where, you know, they're not expert technicians performing those, which allows for a little bit more time. The other thing is that we have a pretty robust process when there's a disagreement on time. And I think more importantly, I think it's important for this discussion, we have an automatic trigger. So if there's a five incidents where the time has gone over from the time guide, it automatically triggers a redoing of the actual perform maintenance in order to try to get a more accurate time. So we're trying a whole lot of things to try to make sure the time is accurate. We, you know, the amendments that were discussed earlier, we haven't seen those. So, you know, we're going to take some time to review those. But in the bill in its current form, and, you know, we are opposed, and we respectfully ask the committee not to advance this legislation and make Alaska an outlier. And thank you for the time today, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lawson. Representative Stutz has a question.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Lawson. I'm curious if your time guide, your publication, is available publicly.
I don't know if the time guide per se is available publicly, but I do have a publicly available video that kind of walks through how we develop our time. I'm happy to send that to you and the committee through the chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. Is there a reason that your time guide might not be publicly available?
I'd have to check into that. I don't know if it is publicly available, and I don't know the reason why, but I'm happy to follow up.
That would be great, Mr. Lawson. I appreciate it if you'd send it to house.transportation@akleg.gov. I think you probably already have that. So we're at 3 o'clock, but with the committee's indulgence, I have two more online to go, so take us another 10 minutes or so to listen to that. So next I have Nicolina Hernandez, Regional Director, Government Affairs, Toyota Motors. If you'd place your name on the record.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Nicolina Hernandez, State Government Affairs Regional Director for Toyota. I just want to echo a lot of the comments that the manufacturer representatives have discussed here today. Jeff is our hands-on expert and has not only technical training, but has firsthand experience with dealing with warranty repairs requests from the dealers. So any questions should be directed to him. But I just wanted to also add that in seeing this bill go through the process, we have done some deep dives into data that we wanted to share. We did provide response to a data request that showed that dealers are, in fact, beating our time guides in Alaska and similarly situated states, as well as what we have come to understand, which is that dealers can request adjustments to any of our time guides. Our data shows that this is not common, and in fact, there haven't been any time guide adjustment requests from the Toyota perspective. Again, dealers are our partners, both Toyota and Lexus. We want them to be successful in Alaska. In fact, one of our Alaska dealers ranks number 5 out of 78 in the region for sales. As was mentioned as well, we're sympathetic to the workforce challenges. We know that a lot of industries are facing a workforce challenges, but at the end of the day, there isn't a guarantee that their compensation would be increased due to this change. And also, in fact, prices will increase across the board, especially to Alaska drivers who seek to get repairs and for their cars. So thank you again. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Hernandez. I have a question from Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I will ask you, is your time guide publicly available?
Thank you, through the chair. I'll have to double check on that. I don't know for certain, but I can get an answer shortly. And perhaps Jeff may know.
Thank you. If you could pass, once you get that information, if you could pass it to the chair of our committee, that would be appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hernandez. Thank you for your testimony. I had one more. Joseph MacArthur, is he no longer online? Okay. Okay, so that completes the public testimony today. I will gavel out of that and I guess look to the will of the committee. I think maybe we should consider holding this until next Tuesday and have a little bit of more chance to garner some public information. I would also like to say that it would be extremely unfortunate if a manufacturer had any retribution to any of their dealers or mechanics for testifying in front of either Labor and Commerce or this committee. I would view that with extreme disappointment, if you will. So, Representative Sumner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would appreciate if we would hold it to Tuesday, because I do have some concerns around Amendment Number 2 that I just want to look into.
If I can. Absolutely. Any other comments? Okay, so I'd like to thank Mr. Goff for being here in Representative Tomaszewski's place. And I'd really like to thank everybody that took their time out on a Saturday to come to this meeting and to testify on this. It's a very important bill. I think that we need to find some resolution, and hopefully it will motivate the dealers and manufacturers to finally talk to each other. So, seeing no other business before the committee, I think we will adjourn at 3:05 p.m. Thank you so much.